chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Happy New Year from Technology Partners and the Something Extra podcast team. It's been an exciting year of episodes, and as I reflect on all of the amazing guests we've had in 2021, I thought it would be fun to have the team put together a few of their favorite moments so we could share them with you. Sit back, enjoy, and thank you for listening and your continued support. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. So, Mark, here we are. Ginger said, "This isn't right. Either you turn yourself in or I'm going to." So what happened next?
Yeah, I told Ginger, I said, "Ginger, you, as I mentioned earlier, that she could be homeless if we turn herself in. But I tell you, she would not back down. I tried for hours to back her down. And I've known her, like I said, since the seventh grade, and I knew she wasn't going to change her mind. So the very day I'm telling Ginger, we're sitting 4 hours with the FBI. So here's this case going on for 12 years. It became the largest price-fixing case in U.S. history, close to $1 billion theft a year for 12 years in a row, started by a stay-at-home mom raising three young children. So we're sitting for 4 hours, and I never forget Ginger say, "Okay, my husband shared what's going on. He's only involved 7 months. We can go home now, right?" And the FBI said, "Your husband just confessed to a $1 billion-a-year crime. He's either got to wear a wire against the kingpins or I have to arrest him today." And that's the choices I had, to either be an informant or be arrested. And that's how I became an FBI informant. So in reality, Ginger's the whistleblower and I'm the informant. And the difference between a whistleblower and an informant, a whistleblower is someone that does all the right things for the right reasons and they sacrifice everything to do it, which is Ginger. And an informant is someone sitting in front of the FBI, I have a choice to be arrested or wear a wire.
And you wore a wire for 3 years.
Yes, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, all day long for 3 years.
Right. But what we've talked about, Mark, it started to wear on you. What was going on with you mentally and physically during that time?
Oh, the FBI, when they wired me up, and there's a documentary on my website on markwhitaker.com by Discovery Channel with all the real FBI agents that were part of the case and the real prosecutor and Ginger and I. And it's a very accurate portrayal of what exactly happened. And in that documentary, and just like they told me, "Mark, if these guys catch you, they're going to kill you." And to hear that, you know, if you get caught wearing a wire, you could end up dead. I tell you, I lost 60 pounds. People at work thought I had cancer. I sleep in 2 or 3 hours a night. I was falling apart. I literally was having a nervous breakdown to the point where Ginger tried to beg to the FBI to have me hospitalized, but they were afraid if I was hospitalized, the doctor would say, "This guy can't wear a wire anymore because he's falling apart." And so they wouldn't allow it. So I was not allowed to see any kind of health care those 3 years during that time.
Oh, had to have been horrific. Your physical body suffered from it, your mental, your emotional, all of that. But what ended up happening, though, is that they did have a case then after you wore this wire, right? Because you were still invited into the inner circle. So they had all of this evidence. You ended up going to prison, too, but it wasn't for that.
Well, during this time, especially after a couple years, I'm wearing a wire, and they're telling me their last few months were kind of coming to an end. And I start thinking, reality, who is going to hire someone wore a wire for 3 years against their own company? It would be easier to get a job as a felon than someone wore a wire for 3 years. I mean, it was going to be impossible. Here at that point, I'm only 38 years old, wearing a wire for 3 years. And I thought, how am I going to keep that home, the horse riding table, the arena, and everything we had at that property? And I was addicted. I was really obsessed with that lifestyle. I never used drugs or alcohol, but I know what addiction is. I had a greed addiction. And I thought, how am I going to keep up with that? And I had all these millions of dollars of stock options that was about a year away from exercising, but the case was going to go public, which means I was going to be kicked out, fired, before I could exercise them. When I calculated, I sold $9 million that they would owe me if this case never happened, you know, like a year down the road based on that stock price. And I thought, there is no way I'm going to keep that $9 million on the table. I risked my life for the FBI. They've told me that every day. There's no way I was going to leave it on the table. So I wrote 5 checks to myself that equated to that $9 million. And I ended up going to prison for that when the others went to prison for price fixing. And I thought my stock options would be a defense, but I learned legally you cannot exercise them a year early.
Yeah. So that did lead you to prison. You would spend 9 years in federal prison. So, Michelle, tell me a little bit about what that was like touring with Toby Mac. And tell us, too, about the lessons that you've learned from music, singing professionally. What are the lessons that maybe you can carry over into other, doesn't matter what role you play?
I'm going to jump back to when I was doing mission work with my dad. I remember seeing the power of God move as I would sing and lead worship and saw how God loved on people. And I said, I wanted to use my gift for that purpose. Fast forward back to the moment when I'm standing on stage with the lights and the smoke and the audience, you know, 20,000 plus people. And somewhere along the lines, I got off of that heart focus. And yeah, it was incredible to hit the stage with these incredible people. And they are who they say they are privately and publicly. They're good people. I mean, it was amazing just being able to tour from place to place and the people that we met and the camaraderie amongst the band members. We came like a family on the road. We cried together. We fought together. We prayed together. We went through some things together. And it was just a wonderful time. But in that place, I got a little lost in my heart and got caught up in all that. So I'm on stage and I'm thinking, how can I get to the front? Lord, release me to my great ministry. I want the lights, the camera, the action. I want all this. Yes, I look like I'm giving you praise, and maybe 50% of that, or maybe 40% of that is you, but I was really enjoying a lot of what was happening. And I'll just be honest with you, I was absorbing that stuff. And I remember praying that the Lord would release me to the world and to the nations. And I remember so clearly, I knew it was Him. He said, you're not safe. And I was like, okay, what does that mean? And basically, I wanted the people to love me, but I had no intention of loving them back. If they're in the audience and they're going through stuff, I just didn't really have time to get involved or emotionally care or take the time to really invest in what's going on in your life. And that's when I knew I'm not safe. Because if you put that kind of person on a platform who's just self-centered, self-focused, it's for them, there's going to be a lot of casualties along the way. And God is not going to be represented in the way that He intended or is supposed to be. So I said, Lord, forgive me. I want to love people and not protect myself from pain and hurt and disappointment. I want to break down that wall. And I want to open up my heart to love people. And I tell you, He really opened up that opportunity for me to do that by me rolling up my sleeves. When I got off the road with them, an opportunity came for me to work at a church, a brand new church that was being built by C.C. Winans and our husband and our family. And they had me come on board. And next thing you know, I'm doing life with people like I never have before. And at first it was uncomfortable. It was incredibly uncomfortable. But I ended up being like a little pastor. I'm visiting people in hospitals. I'm celebrating their kids' birthdays. I'm doing a lot of counseling. I've got 15 ladies coming to my house every Wednesday, and we're sharing the word of God. And I'm being a leader in the church. And so I began to do life with people, and it cultivated a love for people. So now when I get on that stage, now my heart is not, oh gosh, I hope my hair looks perfect. Is my lip gloss right? And you know, I hope someone says, hey, I'll sign her for a record deal. It's, oh my gosh, the people's heart in this audience, Lord, release yourself into their situations, Lord. I pray that as we sing, that your spirit would fill the room and break yokes, break chains, and deliver and set people free from the lies of the enemy. Now that's my focus. And that's what He always wanted from the very beginning. But I went through that process and just be honest with myself and the Lord and say, Lord, this gift is not for me. That's not what this is about. So yeah, and I know there's a lot of people out there who have a dream to sing or whatever their art is, but I would just encourage you to always be honest with the condition of your heart as you do that very thing, because it matters dramatically. God wants to use that gift to literally push back darkness off of people. And if it's for any other purpose, you're misusing the gift. And I never want to stand before the Lord and he says, I gave you a precious gift. What did you do with it? Did you use it for me or for yourself? So yeah, that's what I would definitely encourage you. Do.
I want to fast forward a little bit to when you went to St. Augustine. And I know that St. Augustine High School was an all-boys Catholic school, hard to get into, I think.
St. Augustine is an all-boys Catholic high school. At the time, it was the only all-boy Catholic high school that African-Americans could attend. It was in the middle of integration. I was going from elementary school into junior high. And my mom was afraid to send me to the junior high school because the junior high school previously had been all white. And she was concerned there'd be issues and, I might experience physical harm. And I couldn't go to the school my brothers and sisters went to because the school system was directing integration. So she put me in the local parish school for seventh grade. And there all the boys were taking the exam to go to St. Augustine. And I had no interest because my siblings had gone to Carver. My brother had been a track star there and blah, blah, blah. He was 8 years older than me, but I was wanting to follow in his footsteps. And I just went along and took the test with everybody else. And it turned out I scored really well on the test. I think they said the second or the highest in the city or something. So everybody was super excited about it at the school. And my mom and dad really wanted me to go there. And so that led me going to a summer program, which is what you're thinking of. They took 60 kids from the test and they put them in a summer program, 8 a.m. till noon for a number of weeks in the summer. And the first day they said, 30 of you won't make it. We're only taking 30 into the class. They gave us some lessons and gave us the rules and all that. And right before noon, they handed us the book, Oliver Twist. And they said, you're going to have a test on this tomorrow. Kid raised his hand and said, well, how much of it? They said, all of it. And as you well know, Oliver Twist is a pretty thick book. And so one day to read it. So I went home and I read like crazy. I started reading backwards. I started at the end to find out what happened at the end in case I fell asleep and so on. My mom said, boy, I go to sleep. And I stayed up all night reading. Went in and took the test. And myself and another guy were the only two that got in the high 90s. Everybody else failed because everybody else use Cliff Notes, which I knew nothing about. If I had known, I would have used them too, but I didn't know. So they knew people would use Cliff Notes. And so they had the whole thing rigged. So if you did Cliff Notes, there wasn't one question asked that you can answer from Cliff Notes. And their point was, and that first day is, at St. Augustine High School and in life, there are no shortcuts. And it's sunk in right away with me and it stayed with me forever. And three times a day, in the morning when we arrived, at lunch, and at the end of the day, over the intercom system in the classrooms, they would say, gentlemen, prepare yourselves. You're going to run the world. So three times a day, they barked that at us. And integration was going. The school had gone to court in Louisiana. In fact, there's stuff at the National African American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., around St. Aug and the lawsuits and stuff, so they can integrate Mardi Gras, our band marching in Mardi Gras parades, first black bands to march in Mardi Gras parade along with Southern University. They went to court to integrate high school athletics because the athletics at the time were segregated. And so when I went in eighth grade, all of that was happening. We're playing the majority schools and sports, and I joined the band, marched in the Mardi Gras parades and so on. So it was a big time of change. That was in the late 60s. And it was just a very impressionable time and a time that you really felt the school was super successful, won the national debate contest. We've had over 40-something guys in the NFL. The editor of the New York Times right now is from St. Augustine. John Batiste, the band on the late night show, is St. Aug grad. On and on and on. And a number of executives around, one of my close friends from my class, the other guy who did well on that first test, being one of the top 10 guys in IBM before he retired. And so this little tiny high school, but just with a lot of values and principles and discipline really instilled in us the concept of excellence, what it takes to achieve. And that's kind of the story of St. Aug.
So, Jose, I know that you wrote an article called Reimagining a Better Future for All. And this article really highlights how important diversity and inclusion are in the workplace. In fact, You know, there's a couple of things that you say. Companies that practice with honesty and integrity in the goal of diversity and inclusion will bounce back quicker than those that don't. And they're going to fare better in the long term. In fact, you even have data here, research from Great Places to Work, that showed that publicly traded companies with inclusive workplaces flourished before, during, and after the 2008 recession. And so I know you've done so much work in this area, and it's always been important. You've worked with women forever on women empowerment type programs and things like that. But tell our listeners a little bit more about that.
Yes, and thank you for referencing that article. And the real point was that I think those companies who recognized how important people were to their organization and that they have to bring their authentic selves to their jobs, their whole selves to their jobs, I think those companies, you know, had built that trust relationship with their employees. And those companies who had not invested in that, the care of their employees, are, you know, behind the ball when it comes to being able to bounce back and be able to keep their operations going as easily, you know, as some who had built that trust and relationship with their employees. I think 2020 was such a shock for many and still is very hard for employees. But I think being able to recognize, you know, employees' needs, where they are, and respond appropriately. We saw a lot of companies, you know, especially after George Floyd, you know, when you look at their website, it used to be very white and male. And then all of a sudden after George Floyd, you see the, you know, the website all of a sudden be diverse, you know, so. But when you go behind, you know, and look at their leadership, it's still the same, you know, as it was before. It was a bit of window dressing, I have to say. And, you know, not all the companies needed to do that because they were already there. They were already diverse, both internal and externally. To investing in people and those companies that have been doing that for many years are able to ride this challenging time a little easier than those who hadn't.
Well, okay, so that brings me to something I am super excited about and what you're doing today, which I know you've been working on this for about 3 or 4 years, Jose. It's not just something that you thought about yesterday and voila, here it is today. I mean, you've been preparing, you've been gathering the research. What you're doing today, you're the CEO and you're the founder of GenderFair. And I am so excited about this. I'd love for you to tell our listeners more about GenderFair.
GenderFair, in its simplest form, is like fair trade, but for women. When you look at companies who pledge, make a lot of pledges, you know, and they continue to make pledges. One of the pledges that was made years ago was to the UN Women's Empowerment Principles. We call the WEPs. And these were just guiding principles of creating a safe place to work, having equal balance of genders in leadership, providing good benefits for their employees. So those type of things were guiding principles, but there was no way to measure a company as to their progress, or even if they're making any progress on it. So we created these metrics around those guiding principles, and there's 18 metrics and 5 pillars. So we look at companies' leadership, both on the board, as well as the executive leadership and through management, and if they have leadership development for women. We look at employee policies, whether it's maternity and paternity leave, because paternity leave is almost more important than maternity leave, and other policies from work-life balance and sexual harassment program in place, you know, in the Me Too movement, that was really important, as well as if they've done a pay equity assessment to make sure that there is not any kind of discrimination. And then we look at advertising. And I think this is a really important one because, you know, we want advertising to be inclusive and break some of those stereotypes. Because if you can't see it, you know, you can't be it. And there are a lot of advertising out there that I think they objectify. Also, there's advertising or imagery that have been made over so much that they don't look real anymore. We assess that. And then we look at if a company provides diversity reporting and makes that public. Even if a company is not great on diversity, but just reporting it is a step in the right direction, right? Because then there's transparency, right? And accountability, and you get credit for that. And lastly, we look at if a company helps invest in the community of women and girls, whether it's through STEM education, because we know how important that is. Companies, you know, through their CSR programs are doing a lot more in the community so that, you know, women and diverse populations are thriving.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Halbert made a 180 degree turn with his life transformation. And what he's doing today is so amazing. I'm going to read a couple of stats here. Children in fathers' homes are 22 times more likely to run away, 9 times more likely to drop out of high school, and 5 times more likely to commit suicide. Those are pretty sobering stats. 70% of youth involved in crime and illegal drugs will come from fatherless homes. 82% of teenage mothers come from fatherless homes as well. So you had a transformation. You go to Font Bond. You get a degree at Font Bond. Then you go on to WashU, to the Brown School, get a master's degree in social work. But Halbert, I want you to tell our listeners, in 1997, you felt a call on your life to use your experience to make a difference. So tell our listeners all about the Father Support Center.
All those stats that Lisa just ran off, those are stats that relate to children who grow up in fatherless homes. I wanted to impact the life of a child. I wanted to change the projection of children. And when I looked at those stats, the father is a key figure in all of this. I did significant amount of research while at WashU, looking at fatherlessness and the negative impact that it has, and that's primarily where most of those stats came from. The goal is always to impact the life of a child. The mission of the agency is to foster healthy relationships by strengthening families and communities, and the vision is every father is a responsible father committed to a cohesive family relationship. Now, today, for the last 3 years, we've been working with moms as well, and for about 16 years, we work with youth, but the primary focus is on those fathers. The work we do is very structured. When I look back at my life and the life of others, my mom left New York when I was 16. So I really didn't have any structure in my life. The agency brings structure to the lives of those that work with us. After my mother left, I lost the respect for authority. I lost the respect for self. The agency helps a guy to begin to respect himself, bring up his self-worth so that he can look to do better in life. We currently have about 5 programs, but in each program, there's about 5 projects as well. The number one program is our family formation program, and that's where we do the work with the guys. Very structured process. Structure is key. Part of my thinking when I bring all this structure into things is I grew up doing Vietnam. And what I noticed when I look back at life, there were many guys who went away to service, and that boot camp thing that they went through, when they came back home, they were different people. They stood differently, they thought differently, and they did things differently than what they had did prior to going into boot camp. So we have a lot of structure. The classes are set up 5 days a week, 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock. The reason that we do 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock, one, we have a very comprehensive curriculum and other training opportunities that we want to participate in. But we also want to get them ready for a job. That's our second largest program, is our employment placement and development program. We got to get them ready for a job. At the end of the day, a father has to have a job. We know that parent and child interaction will have a great impact on a child. But you can spend all the parenting time you want. The man needs to have a job. Fathers feel kind of bad when they can't do things for their children. If you think about guy sitting around, he's got parenting time with his baby, and they're having a good time, and then an ice cream truck come down the street. Ding, ling, ling, ling. Y'all know that ice cream truck sound. All the kids is getting ice cream, but he can't get his baby no ice cream because he don't have a job. He feels bad about it. He'll come back a second time. Something of the same nature will occur. He can't buy his baby any Nike tennis shoes. So before you know it, you lose the time spent because he feels bad about not being able to provide for his child. Men love their children just like women do, and we don't want our children to be without. So they start to not come around. That loses the parenting time. Part of our structure involves how you carry yourself. Again, that 8 to 4, getting you ready for a job. You only have one time to make a first impression. So sagging pants is not going to happen at our agency, and it's not going to impress an employer. And what we tell our guys is that the job interview, it starts before you actually sit down with the guy. The job interview starts with the receptionist at that front desk. You come in with your pants falling down, some of those too big clothes, shirts on, and your hat twisted around in the back. When she goes back to let him know that you're here, she's going to tell her opinion. And your interview is over with before it starts. Being on time, our program, our classes start at 8 o'clock, but we want our men here at 7:45. We're working on that job readiness component. In 1998, after I had gotten everything sort of figured out on paper, I had an opportunity to meet with about 150 employers in a group like setting. And I shared with them what I was going to be doing and that I needed some assistance, because once I put them through this 6-week boot camp, they're going to need to have a job. So what kind of training do I need to provide? To a man, each one of them talked about entry-level employment. If you can guarantee that they will be here on time every day, then we'll help you with that employment piece. And so that's why we have the 5 days a week, 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And that's why we have the structure. Part of changing is that you change. If we allow you to continue with your pants falling down, oversized clothing, what change is that? Part of our curriculum goes into parenting, how a father interacts with his child. That's responsible fatherhood, positive parenting. But we also talk about relationship skills building, how to interact with the mother of that child. Regardless of the nature of your current relationship, you need to be more positive in your interaction with the mother of your child. Oftentimes, we have our guys that come to us because they got child support issues. We let them know from the beginning, our goal is to get you to pay child support. That's the number one goal, is to get you financially responsible for your child. We let them know that the child did not ask to come here and that the mother did not produce that baby by herself. And so therefore, she should not be the only one responsible for the finances associated. Research supports to take a child from 0 to 18. It costs anywhere from $270,000 to $280,000. And we've done some of the math. One of the techniques that we'll go through is that the fathers tell us how much it costs a month for a child. That bill often comes up to be anywhere from $2,800 to $3,500 a month. And sometimes these guys are supposed to pay $200 a month in child support. Once we get the figure up on the wall, so you're paying $200, she's paying $26. How does that math work? So you want to know why she's upset whenever she deals with you? Because she has to do all that she can to provide this $2,600, and you can't come up with $200. That exercise gives them a different perspective.
Are you a rising IT leader? Could you benefit from a network of like-minded peers? Let me introduce you to the St. Louis Technology Leadership Experience. This one-of-a-kind program gathers cohorts of IT professionals for 3 workshops: peer small group problem solving, one-on-one mentoring by IT executives, and multiple networking events. You'll be prepared for your next steps as an IT leader by gaining core leadership competencies and a strong, powerful network of peers. To apply for our next TechLX cohort, visit tpi.co/TLX.
Teresa, people may not realize kind of where we are with poverty. Stephen Covey says, start with the end in mind. The outcome that we want is to end poverty. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we were making some strides to that. I mean, we still got a lot of work to do, but where are we right now? And what do our listeners need to know about poverty?
Well, you need to know that poverty is in every community where you are, that it lives in the shadows, that it is on country roads of the names that might not be on a map. The last mile of poverty, as I call it, is in the countrysides. It is in the countrysides of sub-Saharan Africa. It's in the countrysides here in our own country. However, there are 2 things to know. One, ending poverty is the number one sustainability goal. There are 195 countries in the world, and they all agree that ending poverty is necessary for the continuation of the human race. So this is something that affects all of us. And when we can end poverty, we end so many of the other ills that face humanity. Where are we today with the statistics? Well, we got them down to just under 2 digits. So they were at about 9%. And that was after a 25-year decline. So we'd had a lot of progress, a lot of people doing amazing work, our organization included, for what little micron we contributed. But we got a lot of people out of poverty. But together, as a society, as a human race, we got poverty down over 25 years. But as of October of last year, for the first time in 25 years, poverty rates are now back on the rise. And now is not the time, as you've well put it, Lisa, do not grow weary in well-doing. We have a journey ahead of us. And make no mistake, when we can end poverty, we can end malnutrition, we can end hunger, we can end a lack of education, we can end, you know, issues with equity, issues with human rights, because you can't rule a people if they are no longer in poverty. You can't crush them down, right? So many of the issues that we face as a human race are answered by one single answer, which is an end to poverty. So poverty affects us all. It's the first time that it's on the rise, as I said, in 25 years. We've got work to do, but it can be done. Every single person has a role to play.
Yeah. So this is called Something Extra. What is the something extra, Teresa, that you believe every leader needs?
For me, it's compassion. Every leader needs to be compassionate. And it's compassion in the most difficult of situations. So as leaders, we face all kinds of personnel issues, all kinds of very, very difficult decisions. And in my case, I am able to use that mantra, that compassionate mantra of what is in the best interest of the artisans. And then that makes my decisions really, really clear, because that question comes from a place of compassion. I care about this higher purpose that we have of what is in the best interest of our artisans. And that question alone, like I said, it's surrounded by compassion. So I think we all have to be compassionate leaders, and having this mantra helps keep me grounded in that way.
That's great. But Kara, this is called Something Extra. And I have to ask you, what is the something extra that you believe every leader needs?
I think really recognizing that you need to pay attention to your own curiosity, your own desire to do what you feel like doing every single day. And don't get so caught up in, I've been doing the same thing for the last 20 years. In fact, that's the time, I think, to go and take a risk and be on a journey, and don't fear failure. Instead, view it as lessons along the way that you're going to learn to just be a better leader, a better human, and really take all of those learnings and just move forward more than anything else. I mean, if you only have this life to be able to do what you want to do and make a difference, and, you know, as people have talked about, what's on your tombstone? What do you want it to be? That you went out and took risks, you went out and did what you wanted to do? I think so. And that is, I think, more than anything, what I want people to come away from this and my journey with.
Absolutely. Well, Kara, I mean, I don't know, you've got so many things you can pitch, and we didn't even talk about this, but I know you're on a mission right now to make sure that schools have good, clean, pure water. I mean, you've got a podcast called Unstoppable. You're doing so many things, but what would you love for our listeners to know? How can they get involved?
We actually changed the name of the podcast to The Kara Golden Show not too long ago, and it's every Monday and Wednesday. And, you know, I really look for other CEOs and leaders that I think are doing some pretty incredible things that you learn lots of lessons from. But, you know, I think more than anything, pay attention to sort of what I'm working on, because it's always something interesting. And we're waiting to see what we can do around clean water initiative. I'm working with Congresswoman Jackie Speier on that and hoping to take something before Congress, hopefully before the fall. So we'll see.
So Roy, this is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra every leader needs?
I think something extra every leader needs is almost blind, like faith, or just like you said, kind of that belief that you were talking about. It's just something that you just have to believe, is even when everybody else doesn't, or even you have to kind of, even when you see that vision, you have to stick to the course to really see that vision come through. So I would say almost like just that unstoppable faith and belief in yourself and in your vision and your dream.
Yeah, the vision, the mission. Very good. Very good. Well, I want to give you the opportunity. I'm so excited about this. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about what you're doing with Republic.
For sure.
And tell our listeners about this. I'm so excited about this, Roy, because you don't have to be a serial investor to get involved in this, right? I know everything closes in August. So tell our listeners, in case there's somebody out there that says, you know what, I love this idea, I want to help Roy go to that next level.
Well, it started in about 2016. It's about 5 years old. It's called REGCF. So that's short for regulated crowdfunding. And so essentially it's crowdfunding, but the difference is this is specifically for like startup companies and individuals who participate, your contribution or your investment translates to having stock in early stage tech companies. Like you said, it empowers anyone to become an investor, like an angel or a retail investor. And so I thought this was very important. Couple reasons. One is, as I've been learning the VC world, the venture capital world, out here raising capital, you know, pitching, working with angels, et cetera, it's a whole world that I just didn't know existed that I've been learning and trying to share with peers, my friends, family, anybody who's interested in listening. Like, there's alternative ways to raise capital to start your business or to, you know, grow your business. This actually kind of opens up to anybody. So listen, now you don't, like you say, you don't have to be a serial investor. You don't have to be accredited. You don't have to have a certain net worth. Like, you can start investing at $100, you know, and $100 is going to translate into, you know, a small equity stake in the company. And so essentially now we get to create like a grassroots team of people who believe in it, but now are now not only investors in it and can even, you know, be a user of the platform as well. And so basically just empowering everyday people to become investors. So that's why I thought it was kind of a really cool opportunity. It's just now starting to trend. So we're raising $1 million, $1,070,000, but now on these regulated crowdfunding platforms, you can raise up to $5 million. So our campaign is open right now. Yeah. So
how would people get involved? Where would they go? And again, the minimum denomination is $100, right? So with $100, you can get started.
Yeah, to have a small equity stake. And so you would go to just a republic.co/healthy-hip-hop. Or if you could just Google, you know, Republic and Healthy Hip Hop, it'll pop up. And so that's where you go. It's a pretty easy process. You just click right through, say, I want to invest, and then just put your information in and then you're in there. And so that's how you would do it. It's also on any of our social media. You'll find our, on our profile as well.
Very good. Well, this has been so much fun for me, but I would be so remiss if I did not ask you to showcase your skills here. And, you know, there's one that I'd ask you, hey, would you feel comfortable doing this one? I want you to tell the backstory on it, but you've got one out there, chop it up. I know you've got a couple renditions and some of them have like 200 million views. I mean, it's crazy. So tell our listeners and then do just a little bit of it, a couple stanzas, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. And that's 200,000. I wish it was 200 million. But
oh, 200 million. Hey, you'll get there. You'll get there.
It will get there, right? Exactly. So chop it up. Really, it's kind of crazy that you asked about the backstory too, because that kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier. So when I was doing kind of my street rap thing, I started a group and the group was called Chop It Up. It was like the Chop It Up click. And so people from Kansas City who know my history, they knew that. So basically I kind of spun it forward into something positive. So now it's like Chop It Up, but we're just talking about, you know, kind of an old tradition for Kansas City Chiefs fans is to do like the chop. And the reason also, in all transparency, the reason why we're calling it Chop It Up, because before we were calling it the Tomahawk Chop, but we were seeing that was offensive to some Native Americans. So we stopped calling it the Tomahawk Chop. And so we're just calling it Chop It Up now. Right. But yeah, so it's kind of a tradition for Kansas City Chiefs fans. I've always been a lifelong Chiefs fan. Now that we got Mahomes, like, this is a game changer for us. You know, we got the best quarterback in the league. This is the first time ever. But always been a Chiefs fan. Wasn't able to afford to start going to the games until probably like 2013. And that's when I went, got to experience the tailgate, just kind of had that family experience. And then I just spun up a song about it for the fun and love of it and ended up picking up some steam.
Well, sing it for us.
Absolutely. So it's just Chop It Up. It kind of just, that's the hook. But then I talk about the song. So I'm saying KC is the best place to tailgate, barbecue in the air, and it smells great. Posted up over in Lot J, pre-game toast with the Jose. So that's kind of actually breaking down like what we do. So they have different lots. And so Lot J is kind of who has embraced me as like an ambassador for Lot J.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they do like a pregame toast every time with the Jose. So even though it's healthy hip hop, but you know, they do a little pregame toast with the Jose Cuervo.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Very good. Dr. Chapman, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
You know, I'll put a hyphen like you did with yours.
Okay, go right ahead.
One is empathy. A good leader has to develop the ability to ask questions of people and try to put yourself in their shoes so you can feel what they feel and so you can understand what they're saying so that you can honestly say, I hear what you're saying. It makes a lot of sense because it always makes sense in their head. If you listen long enough, you can say that it makes a lot of sense. And I can really see how you'd feel that way. If I were in your shoes, I'd probably feel exactly like you feel. Wow. Empathy. And then hyphen love. And love is an attitude that you genuinely care about the well-being of the people with whom you interface, whether it's in the family, whether it's in business, that you genuinely care about people. And that's love. The attitude of love is, I'm here to enrich the lives of the people that I encounter. And if you have an attitude of love, then it is being expressed in behavior. And that's where the love languages or the appreciation languages can help you express that love, express that attitude in the most meaningful way to the other person. So that's the value. It just helps you express it in a way that's meaningful to them. So it's possible you can be saying to your employees, I appreciate you, really appreciate you, couldn't do it without you. Well, you're hitting maybe 30-40% of your people, but you're not hitting the others because words don't mean much to them.
Right. So, Laura, I have to ask you, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
So I thought a lot about this. And honestly, I think it might seem hackneyed, but I have to say curiosity, because just to the point of where are we going to be in 10 years, there's so much to learn about how we can grow and differentiate ourselves over time. But the thing that I love the most about curiosity is that my dad has set an amazing example. It's always great to ask questions. Whomever you ask questions to, you can learn something. When I go into our stores, talk to a seafood manager, a deli manager, a cashier, and what I learn from them and am able to take back to the business to either create change or make an impact, that's an invaluable opportunity I would be missing if I wasn't being curious. So we try to really instill that in all of our teams. Let's ask questions. And I think that's that collaboration a little bit, that when you are seeking the opinions of others, not only do they feel more engaged, but you usually get to better solutions because you're not looking at things through an isolated window. Honestly, I don't think I would be where I am today without having curiosity as my friend or my partner in the process.
Well, Scott, I have to ask you, this is something extra. What do you believe, Scott, is the something extra that every leader needs?
You know, Dr. Covey wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's often mispronounced or confused as The 7 Habits of Highly Efficient People. There is a difference between being efficient and being effective. One is not better than the other. In fact, I'm a very efficient person. You can tell this from my energy and my productivity. And what has built me my success is my productivity and efficiency. The problem is, with your listeners and viewers that might relate to me, that's my mindset, it's my default paradigm, is that I treat everything in an efficient manner, and you cannot be efficient with people. When you are dealing with relationships, you have to slow down. Dr. Covey said, with people, fast is slow, and slow is fast. So I would argue that something extra is know when to be efficient and know when to be effective. They're both important. Don't try to be efficient in your relationships.
Thank you again for listening. We pray that you and your family have had a wonderful holiday season, and we look forward to sharing more stories with you in 2022.